session number 23848, grill 14.
Mr. Wildgust, grill 14. Right, Mr. Wildgust, I just want to pause at this point in your experiences in North Africa, and just to go back over a couple of points. You talked about some of your men being upset at how the rations were distributed.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just describe, A, what the rations were, and B, how they were distributed before, you know, you took charge of
them? Well, they were rationed in a wooden box, which took a bit of prying open. They consisted of a metal tin with hardtack or biscuits in them, which were hard. There was usually there were rations for seven, which was an awkward amount to split them into, and there'd be so many tins of certainly bully beef, corned beef, soya sausage, which is the first time I've ever come. They were packed in tins and they were square, square shaped instead of being round. They were quite good. There was cigarettes and matches, usually in tins of 50, and soup, McConaughey's meat and vegetable soup, stewed steak, jam, marmalade, peach, I remember peach jam particular, which is a peach preserve, and of course toilet paper and chocolate. Mm. But it was a wrong division, and it was very difficult to be able to give equal rations. Some men had to have, for instance, bully beef, and some had luncheon meat or spam. There was also at times rolled bacon. Bacon was sliced and then rolled in a tin, and you had to unwrap that lot, and you didn't have much time to or opportunity to cook it hot. And of course, to heat, you had what was known as the Tommy cooker, which was like a firelighter made of this white inflammable stuff, I don't know what it's called, and they used to last long enough to be able to heat a billy can of water or cook a meal on. And of course the main thing, I suppose, was the tea ration, which was a mixture of tea, sugar and dried milk, which you just sprinkled onto or poured boiling water onto, and it wasn't bad really, it was quite reasonable. I can't remember ever having coffee, but we might have done. And then that you subsidised, or supplemented, I should say, with whatever you could get hold of, which wasn't much. At our headquarters, we had some roosting guinea fowl, and one of the officers decided that we'd have those, and he shot quite a few, and we made a very good stew. But otherwise, the only other thing we did get was eggs in a fair quantity. And they were either pillaged or bought from Arabs, who seemed to appear even in the middle of battle selling eggs.
Now, you mentioned some of the men being upset about how the rations were split. What were they upset about, that they were getting the wrong...
Well, they felt that they weren't getting as much as the bloke next to you. You know, I mean, that was all it was. And I did virtually all this ration sharing out, and it was very difficult, and I eventually, well, I don't know what I mentioned it before, but I got one or two people who said that they wanted their own ration, so I gave them, and that was it. And that sorted that problem out.
Now, again, at this period, you've joined this new regiment, this mm-hmm. new battalion. How did you get on with your fellow officers, and can you remember much about the officers of this period?
Well, I remember there was a Captain Staniland, who was adjutant, and there was Major Barrel. He was quite a nice character, and there was Major Hefford. I didn't really have much to do with them. They were a bit cliquey with the Lincolns. I don't know whether they were a regular battalion or whether they were a territorial battalion. But certainly one or two of them gave me the impression that they were regular soldiers. The colonel was Colonel Myrtle. He was a friendly sort of chap. I mean, he sort of welcomed you to the regiment. But the others were a bit remote, to put it mildly, I didn't really come in contact with them a lot, apart from when they told me to do things or ordered me to do things.
So there wasn't an opportunity for your order?
No, we didn't fraternise in that sense.
You mentioned the Colonel Welcome when you, how did he?
Yes, he was Myrtle. He was all right. Yeah. Hefford, he was the second in command. He was. He sent me a memo if I would go to the headquarters and would I let him have my cap badge, because he was being sent to the foresters as their commanding officer, and he hadn't got a cap badge and felt that he ought to have something that made him more at home with his new regiment. So I lent him, I gave him my cap badge because I never got it back again, and Wally Binch has still got the memo he sent me asking me for that request. Barrel was a bluff man. He was nice. He was killed, unfortunately, in Italy. And the man I did get on well with was the doctor, Dr. Lart. He and I used to play chess quite a bit, and he was a very... He attended me when I was wounded, and he unfortunately was killed in Italy as well, but I suppose doctors are a different position in a regiment. They're not fighting men, and they treat people generally rather more humanely than others. But there was certainly, even men in the ranks who joined the Linkers said they never felt at home with them. They didn't sort of welcome integration from other people for some unknown reason, and yet I wasn't the only man. I mean, there was Argyll and Sutherland Highland officers, and but it's a very insular business in the army. You're only really interested in the people you're immediately responsible to or responsible for, and you're only interested in anything that goes on within 10 yards of where you are. Anything out of that range doesn't really bear worrying about.
Now,
if you understand a little.
Now, what was their morale like at this stage? They'd been involved in the First Battle of Sedgenay. They were in retreat as you joined them. What was their state of mind?
There didn't seem to be a lot of problems. I had a corporal called Corporal Christian, who happened to come from Nottingham, and he'd been wounded. And he'd early on, and he had recovered and was back in the line again. And he said at the time he was amazed at the amount of blood there was when he was wounded, and he wasn't very happy at having to go back, you know, fight it all again. I met him after the war. He survived the war. He was a teacher, and he used to asked me why I didn't go to reunions and the rest of it, and I said, well, I never really felt at home with the Lincolns. The Foresters had always been my regiment, and so it would remain. But there was certainly resentment among those who had been wounded, and I've always maintained, or did after that, that any man who had seen action, not necessarily to have been wounded, and doesn't want to return, should not be made to. Because it's not, it's a bit of a traumatising experience, quite honestly. I mean, it's,
Now, you were joining the battalion as a young officer, an experienced officer, straight from England.
Yeah.
Did your new colleagues, was there any kind of advice, that, you know, you took this patrol out for the first time, was there any advice that they gave?
No, they... At the time, you don't think of it. In retrospect, I realised that they really were as green as anyone else. They were certainly older, most of them were. And there was always, as there was in my case, which, funny enough, I'd forgotten all about, Major Bell, the Mad Major. There was always a Mad Major in every battalion, I think. He was the sort of man who... He was having a he was with one or two of his NCOs, and a bomb dropped, and I think it killed two of them and wounded another one, and he sort of took the attitude, well, that's hard lines on them. You know, he's one of these sort of people who, if he was in the Scottish Regiment, would play bagpipes on the trenches. And they all seemed to get away with it. They couldn't hit him. He seemed to be a bit, immortal, I suppose, in a way. But when you get people like that, they're not the best people to have as your commanding officers, because they do things that you wish they wouldn't do, because they all seem to get away with it. But Major Bell was my company commander at the end, and he wasn't... he should have given people confidence, but he didn't give me much confidence, quite honestly, because of his general sort of bung-ho, gung-ho attitude.
And how did that affect...
Well, the men all the same. I mean, they weren't very happy because I think they thought he was going to lead him into problems which wouldn't have existed if he was one of these. I may be completely wrong, but he was one of these impulsive men who would do things you thought without much thought.
Okay, have you got any memories of specific things that he did the way you thought?
No, only a hearsay.
So this was like a reputation that preceded him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And what I got, you know, hearing from him.
Now, you were in action for the first time. You led this patrol. You managed men in the front line. How did that put you? What perspective did that put on your training at Sandhurst? I mean, was there a lot of things that you had that you felt were irrelevant now, or did you think?
Well, you never.
A good stand,
you see, or? That was the thing that was never even considered, your treatment of men. You were trained as an officer, but man management sort of never came into the equation at all. It was never discussed. It was implied by them that they did what you told them to do and that you knew what you were doing. But of course, we didn't know what we were doing half the time. And you had to do things as they occurred. I mean, you sort of had to make it your mind to do things as they occurred. And they weren't always the correct thing to do, but... I mean, when we were having this rest period, for instance, lots of the men were in a cave. And it had been old mine workings, I imagine. And they got a fire going and it was belting out and they were all up. And I wanted them outside and they all virtually almost refused to come out. Some I didn't know, some I did. And eventually I had to go in with a revolver and say, if you don't bloody well come out, I'll shoot them. And they came out. But it need, and I remember Major Bell says, are they feeling bloody minded? I said, they are. And he said, well, that's the only way you can treat them. And of course, once they, I don't know whether they were losing their morale or they were so fed up with getting wet because it never stopped raining. I mean, I always said, I'd never complain about rain anymore. It just belted down and... I think that it was more the fact that they were leaving a comfortable fire and having to go outside again. I mean, we gave them rum. Half of them didn't even want the rum. But it was pretty tough going. I mean, you were never dry.
I think you mentioned earlier in the interview, you moved ahead a little bit to this period, and you talked about how you... quickly, you know, acquired a rifle and, you know, forgot about the
Well, yes, I'd forgotten that, of course, because when I got there, I'd only got a revolver, and I'd been told, the only thing I was told, make sure that you cover your pips up and carry a rifle and look as much like an ordinary soldier as you possibly can, which I did. The trouble was, I had to wait for casualties to get rifles because this well-supplied army wasn't exactly well-supplied at all. And what also amazed me was the number of times that if a man was wounded or killed, the rifle or his arm, the handgun thing, got hit as well. I remember once we had some new brand guns that suddenly appeared overnight in the farmyard, and I issued it to a bloke, and the same morning he was back wounded, and a piece of shrapnel had gone through the brand gun, which was useless and had never been fired. And those sort of things you don't think about. And when I asked for a rifle, they said, there aren't any, you'll have to wait until there was a casualty. And eventually there was one, and I got a rifle. And I carried a rifle all the time, because revolvers are useless, we knew that.
What about your fellow officers today in the Lincolns?
Some did and some didn't. One, I always remember Stead, he came through our lines when we were later on, and he was wearing brown kid gloves, and he got his revolver in his holster, and he'd got a stick, and he was walking as if he was on a hike. And I thought, God almighty. But unfortunately, the poor man was killed. But it was surprising how amateur the professionals were. About this time, in fact, after we'd had this rest period, I was told to go on I was to join a reconnaissance party to meet the brigadier. Or divisional commander, I think it was a brigadier brigade, for orders for an advance. And I went with a sergeant and a couple of men, and we duly arrived at the rendezvous where we were met by this brigadier with his red tabs on and his red cap. And he stood on the hillside with his ADC and one or two other officers and said, oh, where are the Boche? Because they always referred to them as the Boche, you know. So the adjutant said, over there, sir, pointing to the horizon. And he said, I think we'd better spread out a little then, gentlemen. And he said, going to spread out a bit, he said. So everybody duly spread out. And he then proceeded to say, well, I'll have the foresters there, and the commandos there, and the 6th Lincolns there. And the Gooms, the foreign African troops, over there. And the Welsh Guards will be here. Very vague about the whole thing. And you then had to go back to your battalion and tell them that they where they were supposed to be. But this was what it was. And you'd have thought he was on an exercise in England. I mean, he was so blasé. Our colonel got killed at a similar O group when there were a mortar battle on a similar O group with a similar sort of bloke, I think. I mean, they made themselves targets for a long way off. And during one of the advances, well, we got stuck behind another battalion and I got orders to pull back. And when I pulled back, I saw this brigadier. He was sort of leaning on us. He said, I say, he said, I think you'd better leave it to them, he said, that's their show, you know, as if it was a sort of a gymkhana, and are you all right, old man, and all this sort of business.
So that attitude, that blasé attitude, I suppose it was designed to instill confidence.
Yeah, well, yes,
seem to have inspired the opposite effect. Was that a common feeling with other people that you knew at this time?
I just thought it was rather strange that they should sort of take this laid-back attitude to things. They didn't explain what was going on, mind you. They all said, only it's their show. He said, we'll leapfrog them in the night. You know, that sort of attitude. And
now, just to put on record, can you remember which company that you were... A Company in the Lincolns.
I got to A Company as Bell, and I was leading platoon in A Company. And when, prior to all this, where the positions were, I'd been told that A Company, a new with your platoon, Vargas will be leading platoon, and he will take your platoon to the start line, start point, where there will be three Churchill tanks. And he said, you'll load up a section on each tank. You will then proceed with the tanks and capture Sedgenay Mine in 2 hours. And as of the time, it had taken them 3 weeks to push it out of it. I thought it was a bit optimistic. And when the attack went in at midnight, and I had got my battalion in the right position, much to my surprise, in the dark, I was then asked by one of my men to go and have a word with some of these goons, these French native troops, who seem to have got themselves lost. And if you've ever spoken to goons who wore sheepskin and carried swords and beards, and the most fearful looking men who went around with their families and goats and drove, in fact we were woken up by them coming by us in the dark, clanking, and before the battalions arrived, they brought all their goats and their children and their wives with them, and their mules, and they got blood money. I think they took ears and that sort of thing. Anyway, they'd lost their way. They didn't know where this battle was. And I said, well, you're supposed to be with the, in my best French at the time, you're supposed to be with the commandos. And the commandos have gone. So they duly departed to find a war of their own. They just went, and very happily, mind you, they just sort of disappeared in the darkness. And when the attack went in at midnight, I have never, ever heard anything like the guns. And it wasn't until recently I found out that they'd given us the whole divisional guns on our front. And it was tremendous. I mean, they talk about El Alamein, but they were firing all over the place. And came the dawn, and we went down to this start line, and there were the three tanks. I thought, well, that's something. And the tank commander showed his head out, and he said, I'm sorry, sir. He said, we can't move. They said there aren't any roads. So I said, well, that's right. And because the night before, I'd been, after this sort of malarkey of putting our positions out, somehow I got on the top of this hill, and there was Lord Lovett there, who was in charge of the commandos, and a French officer rode up on a horse, reared up as if he was in a film. He was in the Foreign Legion. And there were two recce officers, 46 recce. And my cousin, by a strange coincidence, was in 46 recce, so I asked them if they knew him. They said, yes, they did. And I said, well, tell him when you see him that I'm here. And I said, what about these? Oh, he said, clear, he said, those roads have been wrecked. He said, there's nothing on them at all. And they had never been there, because they weren't roads at all. They were mule tracks. And on the map, there was no legend to say what they were, but they were just, and even our battalion had taken them as roads, and there were maps that had been printed by the French about 1936. And where, as I say, we thought there were roads, and where the tanks thought there were roads, there was nothing, and they were impossible to move them, you see. Anyway, I put my men onto these tanks, as I'd been told to do, and a mortar opened up from one of the hills which was supposed to have been captured the night before. And in the end, what had happened was that there hadn't been anybody up there, and then the Germans had seen this attack and decided to move a mortar up there. They didn't camouflage it very well, but I do remember telling the blokes to get off the tanks and take some cover, and I looked up and saw nothing but a big red. Everything went red, which I imagine was a bomb bursting, but I never heard anything. And I asked the tank commander to open fire, and they opened fire on this mortar, and we saw the men running away. And I reported that we couldn't go any further. I said, right, we'll better go on foot. And instead of 2 hours, it took 3 days.
Mm-hmm. Right, Mr. Wilgust, we were talking about this move forward. You'd rendezvoused with the tanks. Mm-hmm. You started this 3-day move into Sedjenain, towards Sedjenain. Now, at this point, I mean, did the tanks, were they able to move at all?
No, the tanks decided that they couldn't move. I think I mentioned before, what they had taken to be roads were actually mule tracks. And were marked as such. They were marked as roads on the old maps, because these maps were printed in by the French in the middle 30s and were out of date then. And apart from giving some offensive fire to the mortar that opened up, that was the last we ever saw them. I don't know what happened to them after that. We were given orders then to advance on foot. So instead of a 2-hour operation as had been envisaged, we became infantrymen again and proceeded up these hills, which are very much like marching in Derbyshire, really. Plenty of stones and plenty of clattering and falling about. And as we got up the mountains, we came across stragglers of the Goums, the French Moroccan troops, who were patrolling the hill that they captured with swords and wearing sheepskin and looking very, very savage and barbarous. Barbarous, is that the right word? Anyway. And also on the way down, or coming down, were German prisoners. Some of them saluted with a certain amount of respect, actually. They didn't sort of ignore us. They didn't look down on us in any way. They didn't sort of appear snooty, as a lot of Germans tend to. They sort of seemed to accept it. I do remember one of my privates who said, because it was Sunday morning and the sun was shining a little, he said, I know what I'd be doing if I was at home now. He said, I'd be going to the pub. And that's all stuck in my mind. What a funny place to be on a Sunday morning. Anyway, we advanced up the hills and into various woods and thickets until eventually, I don't know how far we were going, probably a mile into the mountains, we were ordered to stop and dig in. But nobody really knew what was happening. We were getting some, what they now term as friendly fire, shells falling on our side of the hill instead of going over the top. But I remember we just watched them explode and we didn't sort of hold anybody responsible. We accepted it as one of the things that happened. Unfortunately, they didn't fall near enough to cause any casualties. And the digging in, of course, was the worst part, because in Tunisia you can only go down about 6 inches before you reach solid rock. And it was a very laborious exercise, given the tools that we had, the entrenching tools. It took a very long while to even get down a couple of feet. But eventually we did that, and I remember the Sergeant Jones, had dug himself a reasonable slit trench, which at least he could lie in, even if he couldn't stand in it or squat in it. I didn't bother, I just left it for hoping that other people would do the job for me. I didn't really have any need to dig in at all. What happened then I can't really remember, apart from the fact that it started to rain. And it wasn't the first time it had rain in Tunisia, particularly in the mountains, and it bucketed down. And so we were wearing battle dress, but also balaclavas and anti-gas capes and Macintosh, made of rubber type cape, ground sheet cape, as protection. And it was cold, particularly at night. I don't think any of us, no, we didn't wear greatcoats. It was purely covering from the rain, which was the main problem. And during that night, when we tried to get some sleep, I was lying out in the open in a wood, and I remember putting my hand out and feeling my sergeant's